Tonight on Arena, we'll be discussing Irish movie Arrogt, Matt Damon in The Last Duel, and Marvel's Venom Let There Be Carnage, and Paul McLoone on the Velvet Underground documentary. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. It's movie night on Arena, of course, being Thursday. This week's cinema releases transport us to famine-stricken Connemara, medieval France, and yet again, the Marvel Cinematic Universe. The Last Duel is, of course, the reason for Matt Damon's extended residency in Dalkey. It's also the first of two Ridley Scott movies to be released this autumn. It's about the events that led to the final hand-to-hand duel to death ever held in France. Venom Let There Be Carnage sees Tom Hardy reprise his big franchise role as a man with very different sides to his personality. And Arrogt is the debut feature film from writer and director Tom Sullivan about the horrors of the famine shown through the prism of one man's life and loss in the west of Ireland. With me this evening to discuss all three, Paul Whittington and Cara O'Doherty. We'll start with Arrogt, an Irish word meaning monster. Tells the story of a man called Coleman Sharkey, whose life, like so many at the time, is devastated by the famine. And indeed, the lack of response to that catastrophe. The dialogue in the film, predominantly spoken as Gaeilge. So, Cara, maybe you'd start off by telling us, where exactly is Coleman Sharkey in his life when we meet him at the beginning of the film?
We meet him when he is a happy family man. He's a beautiful child and a wife. He's a fisherman and a potsheen maker. And he has a nice house. And he's doing quite well for himself, despite the fact that he obviously has to pay dues to the landlord like everybody else. But they're a respected family. Things are going well. But word is spreading that a blight is coming across the country. And they know that it's on the way. And it's the big question of how much damage will it do when it gets there. So he's worried. But, you know, he's holding his own and doing well for himself.
And that family side of his life, it does paint a pretty nice picture. But very quickly, Paul, we're in a world where the bailiffs or the lackeys of the bailiffs are coming along looking for an extra pound of flesh.
Yeah, and Coleman feels this is unreasonable. Mm. And so he goes along to see the local landlord, who's played by Michael Hatton, who does a great bad guy, although it's a bit more nuanced than that. And his brother and an army deserter called Patsy Darodevny go along with him, and it goes bad, and bad things happen, and he finds himself in the frame.
Let's go back a little bit, though, to that character of Patsy, if we could, Cara, because he's important. This we think he's a deserter, but we're not quite sure who he is. He's the classic stranger comes to town character, isn't he?
He is. He's got a glint in his eye that you just he's very unpredictable. You wouldn't really know what he's planning to do, but he has an edge. The local priest asks Coleman, can he give him a job? He has left the army, possibly as a deserter. Nobody is quite sure. The story seems to change depending on his mood, and he's an angry man. And when the landlord's men come to collect the rent, they've done this in peace every other time, but because he's there now, he gets very aggressive and leaves Coleman in a bit of a pickle to try and talk down the lackeys for the landlord.
Right, well, let's go to that scene, in fact, where it's Patsy who's confronting those guys who have come along. One of them, Seamus Tom Haig, is holding a gun in front of all of them, saying, come on, let's deal with this. So the landlord's men looking for their money, they're carrying a gun, and Coleman is very unhappy. Donal O'Haley as Coleman here, Dara Devaney as the troublemaker Patsy, and it's Sean T. O'Malley who plays the character of Seamus. Tá sé fála anois. It's empty now as he shoots the gun up into the air. Dara Devaney as the troublemaker Patsy at the end of that clip. We also heard Donal O'Haley as Coleman and Sean T. O'Malley as Seamus Tom Haig. the Irish in this, yes, it's subtitled throughout, but it's very, even the way in which it's used, it's very understated, Paul.
It's very understated and very natural. And there are two things. There was another famine film, people remember Black 47,
yeah.
And it was a Western, and it was kind of angry about it, which of course is entirely legitimate. But the tone in this is sort of sad. And two things really make it powerful for me. One is the Irish language and the way it's used. And it's used in a very natural, sort of unobtrusive way. And of course, it is the language that the majority of the people who died in the famine spoke. And the second thing is natural light. Connemara, natural light. It's this ghostly effect is created naturally. It's an amazing looking film.
A ghostly effect because there's a kind of a bleakness about it. It struck me that this is a post-apocalyptic movie in some ways, but the apocalypse at that time was the famine, Cara. It has that feel of its bleakness, but also a kind of a bleak beauty.
It is. It is very beautiful, actually. It's rare to see that the landscape in a way. I mean, you can go on your holidays and it's such a beautiful escape and yet twist it around and it's a bleak, dark, difficult place. But yeah, unlike Black 47, this very much speaks of kind of the silent horrors that starvation and pain and anguish brings. Black 47 was a powerful film and no less important, but it was very much a violent kind of driven in that direction. But this is a much more subtle affair. And because of that, it's all the more heartbreaking.
Yeah, let's listen to another section from the film, this one in English. And this is where Coleman and the lads have gone to the landlord to kind of try to broker some kind of a deal at one level, but also to say, look, sorry about the messing around with the lads and firing the gun off up into the air. And it's Michael McElhattan who is the landlord in this clip.
Sometimes it's best not to intervene.
Then don't raise the rates. Not now. Be nothing here but graves come spring.
Nonsense. Crops have failed before and mortality levels have been perfectly acceptable. No. I feel that these current hardships will improve the mettle of the people. It's a godsend.
God has nothing to do with this.
Careful, Coleman. Don't think you can trade off my fondness for your father's memory.
Michael McElhattan and Donal O'Haley there in a scene from Arrochs. And a great line in the midst of that, Paul.
Mortality
rates were perfectly acceptable the last few times that the crops failed.
Yeah.
Again, even in that, the easy thing here would be English landlord bad, Irish peasant workers good.
Mm.
But it's way more nuanced than that.
It is, exactly. It gets at the kind of the sort of almost intimate relationship between some of the landlords and the peasants, and they weren't all, you know, awful and so forth. The interesting thing about this film as well, it's of course 1845, so it's only the start of it.
Yeah.
And when he goes to the island, when he has to hide, that island becomes a kind of microcosm for what's going to happen to the rest of the country.
Yeah, because without giving too much away, he has to flee for certain reasons because of these awful events that happen in the landlord's house immediately after the scene we've just been listening to, Cara. But it's there that he strikes up this relationship with a young girl, a little girl called Kitty, played by Sacha Nguyen.
Yeah, he meets Kitty, and the sad thing is Kitty has gone through a trauma and doesn't really know who she is or where she's come from. And he has gone through these terribly difficult experiences. So he takes her under his wing. He's bereft. He's plagued by nightmares. He wants to die, but he can't. And now he has this child to take care of. And there's a beautiful relationship between them because he can't leave her. She knows that she can help him as well. And they become very dependent on each other. But his main plan is to get her back to the mainland and to give her to somebody who can take care of her, possibly down the line. But before he gets a chance, they form this very beautiful relationship, a bit of push and pull, a bit of anger between them. As she starts to remember where she comes from, and that they realise that their stories actually intertwine to past events.
Again, there could be an inclination with a famine story like this to go for melodrama in some way. There's no melodrama here. It's the underpinning right across the board. People who are starving and who are absolutely desperate, who need to kill possibly to get food.
Yeah.
All of this is played with total truth.
It is, and I think that's a very important part of the film's success. Donal O'Haley is he is under all the time. He's a person who has to remain in control of his emotions because of what he's seeing and what he's about to experience. And that presumably is true to how people had to cope, those who survived. So I think that's very strong, that it's all under, there's no melodrama, as you say, there's no, over emoting.
Yeah, and some of that, praise for that, getting those performances from right across the actors in the piece, I thought, Cara, must go to Tom Sullivan, the writer and director here.
Oh, absolutely. It's perfectly cast. But from Dara Devaney playing Patsy with devilishly evil glint to Michael Madden-Hattel, who could have played that as quite a kind of a stereotypical nasty man. But again, he's understated. Everybody really just plays it in a very understated, which brings much more reality to it. And you really can't, you can feel that this is a lived experience of our ancestors.
Right, you, I don't know if enjoyed is the right word, but you were both certainly quite moved and impressed by this. How does that go into, we might give them Réalta this evening, we might give them stars instead of the Réalta this evening, Paul.
Is it Cathru Réalta then?
Cathru will do, Cathru Réalta from Paul. And what are you saying, Cara?
Cathru Mhisce Freshan, if I said that wrong, then have I?
That's you've said it perfectly understandably. Four from both of you is what we're getting. So congratulations to all involved in Aireacht. The first of our three films this evening. Let us move on then to an Irish connection here for sure in The Last Duel. Matt Damon brought him to Ireland to welcome, as a welcome summer guest, it must be said, in Dalkey. The Last Duel, though, is an epic knightly court drama based in 14th century France, tracking the true events that led up to the last legal duel to take place there. We are really in a kind of a Rashomon type of tradition here, stories told from different points of view. But what is the kernel of the story that's been told, Cara?
So the kernel is it's about three central characters, Jean de Cruge, I'm sure I'm saying that wrong, played by Matt Damon, and he's a bit of he's not a knight yet, but he's a fighter. He's paid to fight. He needs a wife because he's running out of money. The outplague has reduced his workforce, and he finds a wife with fortune, Marguerite, played by Jodie Comer. Carouge's former best friend is Jacques Legris, played by Adam Driver. He saved his life in battle. They were friends, but Legris has gone off to become the bestie of a count, played by Ben Affleck. And I'm simplifying it now terribly, so. But the long and the short of it is they have a difficult friendship, and a few years later, Marguerite says that Legris came to the house when Carouge wasn't there and raped her. Because of this, Carouge demands that he have permission to duel Legris to the death. Legris obviously denies it, and they get permission for the king to have a
duel to the death.
A legal duel.
I suppose what's important here as much as anything else, yes, it's two men fighting over, in the case of the Matt Damon character, over the honour of his wife. Mm. But it also comes down to something a little bit more sinister than that. It's his property. So therefore, he's feeling aggrieved, not for her, but for his own property, which is an interesting take on it.
It's the reality of how things were in medieval France. And in fact, at first, Jean de Carouge doesn't want to take on he doesn't believe her. He doesn't want to take it on. But then he feels his honour has been, because his property has been damaged, as it were. So the interesting thing about this film, it's Damon and Affleck who wrote it. It's the first time they've written anything together since Good Will Hunting.
Wow, yeah.
And I think they do a very good job, actually, of telling the three different stories. Hers is last. That's crucial because it acts as a corrective to all that we've seen before. Like Matt Damon's character, Jean de Carouge, thinks he's kind of this kind of gruff but noble person.
Yeah, let's listen to him actually give us a sense. He's feeling very aggrieved and very important, self-important, I think you could even say, as Jean Carouge here, venting his spleen about the behaviour of his former friend. This is Adam Driver's Jacques Legris, who we'll hear at the end of the clip.
I will not be patronized by this squire who lies about court, waiting to be fated with gift upon gift upon gift, and risks nothing, nothing. He may acquire more property in this world, find more favor, eat more, drink more, bed more, and otherwise call himself a man of arms. But in this hall, and any other, in my company, he will call me sir. Sir. Sir.
Indeed, good sir. Enjoy your time in Paris, Sir Jean.
Little short retort there from Adam Driver as Le Gris, and then the big
you
speech.
You should remember, Sean, that all of that is being said from beneath a mullet.
That both Matt of them Damon, are one of them. Matt Damon's mullet.
Matt
is
Damon's
it?
Mullet. So that, no wonder he's in a bad mood.
And to counter that, Adam Driver has very beautiful floppy hair. So, you know,
floppy hairs and mullets. But what struck me most about that is, what's with all the terribly clipped BBC 1950s English accents?
Well, I don't know how Cara feels, but I would say I don't think that if you extract it like that and you can't see it, your tittering
yeah,
is understandable.
That's what you see, right? But, or that's but, what you hear,
but,
rather.
But,
yeah.
But I think in the course of the film, because as you know, all actors have to reach a kind of accommodation in terms of what they're going to do with that. I didn't think it was a problem. Particularly, that sounds a bit Monty Python when you extract it from the film, but
okay,
it wasn't
fair
a problem
enough
for me.
Yeah, yeah. And Harriet Walter, which part of England is she not from? I believe, Cara.
Her accent is quite different again. At the press conference, Matt Damon made a big deal about the fact that they didn't want to have the stereotypical period drama English accent because they're French fighting the English. They couldn't have that, so they came up with a new accent that's neither French nor American. But to be honest, I don't think they were all in the same room when they agreed. Read on it on that day. Harriet Walter has gone for something entirely different. Yeah. I mean, she's a wonderful actor. It's a great performance, but her accent is from a different country.
Hello, I don't want to get bogged down on the Harriet Walter side of things, but I'll stay with you on this because Paul mentioned earlier, Cara, that it's very important. We get the three sides of the story. We get, first of all, Matt Damon's character, Le Carrouge, and then we get the Le Gris character, the Adam Driver character, and then we get Jodie Comer as Marguerite, the aggrieved woman here. How important is it that we get her story last? And what does this maybe shifts the film in a way that I certainly wasn't expecting?
She's remarkable. In all three chapters, she protests that this has been done to her and that she wants people to know the truth. But in this last chapter, not only is she very powerfully saying what happened and being brave and bold, we see the men around her. And we see how women actually respond. The Banaflex Count is an awful rakish fella who is very proud of how he treats his wife. And in this chapter, we see the wife just make a face at one point, and we see what she actually has to put up with year in, year out. And different female characters have it's just small glances. It's tiny little moments where we see just what people had to put up with in medieval times when women were treated solely as property and nothing else. And Jodie Comer really is. She is so powerful, so assured and so brave in every decision that she makes that she just says, this is my truth, this is my story.
Yeah, absolutely. Because she's not just making a face in the clip that we're about to hear. She's putting it right up to Matt Damon's character about what exactly is going on and where the power is lying and what the story that she wants to tell.
You knew what would happen to me should you lose this duel. You knew, and you didn't tell me.
God will not punish those who tell the truth.
My fate and our child's fate will be written not by God's will, but by which old man will tire first.
How dare you speak to me this way?
What if I lose? I begged you to find another way, and now I may be burned alive.
I am risking my life for you.
You are risking my life, so you can fight your enemy and save your bride. And that could render our child an orphan. Or did you not think of that?
That's Jodie Comer and Matt Damon in a scene there from The Last Duel. I was asking Paul as we were listening to that, is it her film?
Yeah, absolutely, it is her film. And the men play their parts well, there's no denying. And the final battle or the final duel is a staggering piece of violent filmmaking.
Brilliantly done, yeah.
Absolutely amazing. Mm. But it is Comer's film. It's Marguerite's story. Comer has done this true woman story proud. Yeah. So it really is hers. Very surprised not to see her on the Oscar nomination list this year.
Which is close to what you were saying to me as we were listening to the
absolutely.
Clip.
Yeah, absolutely. I think she's, because I haven't always got on board with what she does, but I think she's exceptional in this. And as Cara says, she had to almost show three faces of the same person in the three different versions that she manages to do it. I would say Ben Affleck is actually very funny deliberately, and he adds some some much needed lightness.
But another odd hairdo here, I believe.
Peroxide hair, and it doesn't suit him, but he's great in it as well. So no, it's very good.
I should have said Harriet Walter. I was asking this, but Harriet Walter plays Matt Damon's mother. That's the character that she's playing in the midst of all of this. Okay, I suppose this time we should go for Étoile. S'il vous plaît.
Pour moi, quatre étoiles.
Quatre. Okay, four again. And what are you saying for stars, Cara?
Can I answer in German? Because my French is really bad.
You must.
Have a go.
Cat sank, is that right?
I don't know. You're saying four, are you?
Yes, four for me. It could have been a five. There's a couple of tricky things.
You're kind of in between the two.
It could have been exceptional, but it's very good, and I'll settle with very, very good instead.
All right, so between four and five, but not quite getting there. So you've had two very good experiences so far. Let's move on to film number three, Venom, Let There Be Carnage. This is a follow-up to a Spider-Man spin-off of Venom. This time, Venom, Let There Be Carnage stars Tom Hardy as Eddie Brock, a man with a fairly mixed-up personality, it would have to be said, Paul.
He does, yeah. He has been inhabited by an alien succubus, Sean, called Venom, who wants to eat people, basically. And so he's a freelance journalist. You know, they're not that bad. So he has to reach an accommodation with this character. In the first film, which was really noisy and full of bad effects, various things happened and he lost his girlfriend, played by Michelle Williams. In this film, they've reached an accommodation, but then they have a falling out. But Tom Hardy has managed, whatever about the rest of this film, he has managed to find a way of making this work, and his Venom is kind of like a sort of bad Shakespearean actor or something. He's quite funny in it, actually.
I think we can listen to a clip which gives us a sense of, because he has to play both characters.
He does.
Yeah, and he obviously was watching a lot of Star Wars and a lot of Darth Vader vocal effects.
Yes, Venom has been consuming popular culture indiscriminately, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Well, let's have a chat then between Eddie Brock and Eddie Brock as played by Tom Hardy.
This is about me wanting to live without you, whining in my ear all the time about eating bad guys, or like nagging me about Anne, or destroying my place, or destroying my life.
Do you know how lucky you are that I chose you?
You chose me? But I'm the only person that took you in when your friends kicked you off the planet Ming Mong, because you are a reject. You are a pariah. Lethal protection, my ass. You couldn't protect anything. You are useless. You can get a job down here cleaning toilets.
I'm sorry. I don't know what came over me. Please, let me fix it.
How about it? It's
like a freaking attack. Yeah.
That's his Tom Hardy as Eddie and Venom and Cara. I presume he broke the toilet at the end of that clip.
He broke pretty much everything that was possibly could be broken, except for the chicken that you could hear in the background. The chickens get to live to another day. Hmm.
And what about the CGI in this, Cara? It plays a big role. Is that a mess or is it, what is it?
Terrible. There's no excuse for how bad it is. Venom himself is fine when he's attached to Hardy or coming out of him. But even in the opening sequence, there's a clip of him kind of climbing up a building, and it doesn't even look like a fully rendered building. There's bits falling off. It's quite and as it builds up into the later fight sequences, it's very hard to see what's going on. I mean, I sound like I'm 105 here going, very hard to see what was on the big screen. But it's just a big blur of arms and legs and shouting Tom Hardy.
We've Tom Hardy, we've Stephen Graham, who's in everything at the moment. I saw that he was in this as well. Woody Harrelson is there, Naomi Harris is there, and Michelle Williams is there. That's quite a cast.
It is indeed quite a cast. I mean, some of them, Michelle Williams just kind of pops in to say hello, really. She's not really used very much. And Naomi Harris is fine in a role that is kind of a strange one. And Woody Harrelson does what he does. He brings that sort of oily southern charm to bear on the role he plays. And he's inhabited by another monster and so forth. And the end of it, as Cara says, I mean, it's very, very busy. I will say that I thought this, I really didn't like the first one. And I like this a bit better because of what Tom Hardy does. Do you know what he did? He had a recording of himself as Venom playing in his ear when he was doing the scene. So he was just totally acting with himself. Amazing.
I have certain reservations. However, yes, that is the way he went about it. That is fine. He listened to himself and then responded to himself. Sounds a little bit self-obsessed in some ways.
It does.
But possibly the character needs that. You are the opposite in terms of the film's carry. You preferred the first Venom to this second outing.
Yeah, the first one had its problems, don't get me wrong. But it was quirky and it was unexpected. And I loved Tom Hardy and his just bizarre behaviour in it. Mm. I think it really suits him being... I wouldn't be surprised if this is the closest we've ever gotten to the real Tom Hardy. I have visions of him actually having these conversations in his own bathroom.
Listening.
I hope not. Sorry, Mr. Hardy.
Yeah, acting with himself.
I really do. See, I'm not surprised when Paul said that. I was like, I can believe this.
Yeah.
But the actual film of this one, it's lazy. I mean,
I didn't realise when I said Let There Be Carnage that that was what was about to ensue. Director Andy Serkis is not getting Etwall or Realta in this one. What's he getting? I don't know, toilet bowls possibly. What's he getting from you, Paul?
I think I'll give him Etwall. I think I'll give him Deux Etoiles et demi.
All right, so
two and a half is
what you're getting. Yeah, you're giving in this one. And what are you saying overall? And we can go in English for the sake of the night.
Please.
Thank you. Or can I say it in Venom?
Yeah,
I'm going to try Venom language.
Yeah.
Does that sound venomish? I don't know.
I'll go for it. I'll take that. I'll accept your two. That's Paul Whittington and Cara O'Doherty speaking to us about three films this evening. Arrogh, The Last Duel and Venom Let There Be Carnage. All of which, Carnage, why do I want to say Carnage all the time for that? I don't know. All of them released in cinema. A quote often attributed to music producer Brian Eno is, the first Velvet Underground album only sold 10,000 copies, but everyone who bought it formed a band. That statement summarises the profound influence of the Velvet Underground, which included songwriter Lou Reed, guitarist Sterling Morrison, Welsh musician John Cale and drummer Mo Tucker. Along with the German singer Nico, they are credited with inspiring generations of other artists, from David Bowie and Nirvana to Arctic Monkeys and U2. Now Todd Haynes, director of Oscar-nominated films including Carol and I'm Not There About the Life of Bob Dylan, has made a documentary about the music of the 1960s New York-based group. Paul McLoone has been watching the documentary for us. He's with me in studio this evening. Maybe your own introduction to the Velvet Underground, first of all, Paul, because I think everybody probably remembers the moment they first heard this band.
Absolutely, very much so. I remember it really vividly, actually. It was back in 1986, a long, long time ago, and a sunny afternoon. I was in Queen's University at the time, theoretically studying English literature. Not on this occasion. I was dossing in a mate's room. Anyway, he had Velvet Underground. Now, I'd heard of the Velvet Underground. Mm. I was aware of who they were. I'd even heard a couple of tracks, but nothing had really hit me. And then I heard Venus and Furs, the first album in general, actually. But Venus and Furs was the one that really struck me. And the voice of Nico on that album as well, which I think doesn't get enough attention. But anyway, that was the beginning of an obsession. And around the same time, there had been an album of unreleased 60s, later period Velvet Underground tracks called VU, that had emerged. But really, the Velvet Underground records had been a little hard to get your hands on, some of them anyway. Certainly, I found it difficult to find them. But then, lo and behold, they were on the South Bank show, and the same week, there was a box set that came out. So that's where some of the student grant went, you know, so which is what they're for.
Yeah.
I immersed myself in the Velvets and became, to this day, pretty much unashamedly obsessed with them. You know, I just think they're tremendous.
It is extraordinary when you think of it. We're talking about a handful of albums, really.
Very few records, yeah. Four main albums and a few compilations of unreleased stuff and some live stuff, and that's it. It's hardly a vast catalogue, and it's been absolutely mined, I think, to the limit now at this stage. But it remains such a key influence on generation after generation.
Not a vast catalogue, but as Brian Eno said, you know, lots of people who listened went off and formed a band as a result of it. And it's interesting that despite that legacy and that influence that the Velvet Underground had, there hasn't really been a major documentary about them, has there?
No, not on this kind of scale, and certainly not courtesy of someone of the stature of Todd Haynes. And although that is surprising, it's probably down to a few things. Perhaps they're just they're a little kind of difficult to make a hugely interesting documentary about. Not that he hasn't managed that there, but I could see in a conventional sense it might be a bit of a, they were there for a while and then they split up and loads of people have been influenced by them, but the story itself perhaps doesn't have the drama and the kind of, you know, it's not long enough maybe and doesn't have the ups and downs that maybe have in other stories. But Todd Haynes does a very, very good job of overcoming that, and also the other chief hurdle, I think, which is the fact that despite being under the wing, at least initially, of Andy Warhol, a man who never went anywhere without a movie camera, and being the centrepiece of his audiovisual extravaganza, which he called the Exploding Plastic Inevitable, where it was lights and dancers and the Velvet Underground playing and all this crazy visual stuff. Very, very little footage of the Velvets live even exists.
But he's very clever, his Haynes, in the way he presents this documentary, because what he gives us initially is context, and that is what's so important here. You've got to get into 1960s New York, the Beatports and everything that was happening. That's the milieu.
It really is how he makes it work. He makes what is, as I say, a fairly rudimentary story of a band who weren't around for a very long time by putting it in the context, especially in their initial kind of burst of creativity under the wing of Andy Warhol and the factory scene, putting it in that context and exploring that context courtesy of footage from, well, Warhol's portrait kind of footage and also a lot of the footage of the great Jonas Mekas, who was an underground filmmaker at the time and who documented a lot of that period. That's really where he succeeds, is by very cleverly using split screen techniques and voiceover archive stuff and interviews with a couple of the survivors. And he puts you very much in that, as you say, in that milieu of 60s
counterculture. We hear the voice of Lou Reed, obviously, from previous interview from archive. And in the clip we're about to hear, John Cale is in here as well, and Terry Phillips. And they're talking about how Pickwick Records effectively were kind of a bargain label. Yeah. How they chose the Velvet Underground to do something with. And you'll hear Cale, Reed and Terry Phillips in this clip.
As a staff songwriter on a budget label in Long Island City, I moved to New York.
Pickwick was a very successful budget record company.
99 cent records, 12 surfing songs, or 12 we're breaking up songs, and they would sell it in Woolworths.
He had a vision. He was talented beyond his talent, if you understand what I mean. He can't sing, he can't play, but everything he does in that craggly voice of his resonated with me. With Lou, we were going to blaze a trail, which eventually he did.
Tony got an invitation to a party. We went up there and this guy comes up to us and said, "Hey, you guys look very commercial. Would you like to come and promote a record? Now come out to Long Island City." And it was Pickwick Records, and their songwriter at the time was Lou Reed. When I met Lou, there was a lot of eyeballing going on.
That's John Cale talking about the moment when he met Lou Reed. And really from there, Paul McLoone, in this documentary, The Velvet Underground by Todd Haynes, he sets up what the ingredients that were there, and it was the Lou Reed lyrics, the John Cale music. That was what was so important here.
Absolutely. And it's a really kind of heady mix, really. Cale coming from the Tony he's alluding to in that clip is Tony Conrad, who was a very experimental musician, had a setup called the Dream Syndicate. They used a lot of drones, and that was the very modern kind of almost, I guess, a neoclassical modernist kind of.
Yeah, they
of
were
music.
Minimalists. They were really into this idea of just let's have one note and listen to it for an hour and a half.
Really? Yeah, exactly. And really in the vanguard of the kind of the extreme new music from that classically backgrounded kind of area. So you got Cale coming from there with his viola skills and piano. He also turned out to be a great bass player, which didn't hurt. And then that collides with Reed, who's coming, you know, has literary ambitions, and we might argue literary pretensions, and but is a dyed in the wool doo-wop fan, grew up listening to all those great doo-wop records. It was absolutely his passion, that and early rock and roll, real kind of bubblegum sort of kind of sensibilities, but with a tremendously literary thrust throughout. Yeah. And the two of those coming together is really, really a very mix for a very, very potent mix, really. And
gives you a song like this. As I'm listening to that, just that first verse of I'm Waiting for the Man from the Velvet Underground and Nico, the first album from the Velvet Underground, it really is simple. Musically, it's a three-chord trick, but the lyrics there.
Yes, and it is indeed. It's a very, very simple in terms of the structure of the chords. But those lyrics, he's just very matter-of-factly with no kind of particularly moral position. I mean, the way Reed discusses the whole subject of drugs on that first album, I think, is really, really powerful. Mm. And he's not taking a position, as I say, and he's just very much matter-of-factly, but also very poetically. He manages to make very simple statements, but in a very artful way. And I think it's just a tremendous lyrical talent that he maintained, I think, pretty much throughout his career. And he always made a virtue of the simplicity of the music. That isn't to say it's not very powerful music and very powerfully rendered and performed and very impactful. But when you actually break it down in terms of the musicality of it, much of it is, yes, very and very willfully and knowingly, very, very simple and straightforward. Yeah.
What about you were saying at the beginning of the item, Paul, that you feel that the Nico part of the story is often not told or not credited in terms of what she brought. Particularly,
absolutely.
She was only there for the one first album.
Album. She only sings, I think, four songs. Mm. But you know, as Mo Tucker, to your credit, actually says, and Nico is discussed, I think, a little too briefly in the Todd Haynes film. One little criticism I would have of what is otherwise a very fine documentary is that maybe Nico just deserved a few more minutes because she's a fascinating kind of character. And as Maureen Tucker says, it's great that she was there to sing those songs because she's perfect for them. And you know, Lou Reed singing those songs just really wouldn't have worked, and it just elevates the album to a whole other level of kind of artfulness. I think it just makes it a much more fascinating listen. Mm. And she just has this voice that is not a traditional pop voice at all, but it just works so well when applied to the songs that Lou Reed very cleverly, slightly against his will initially. She was foisted on the band to some extent by Andy Warhol.
Yeah.
But it works tremendously well. I think it's a great shame she didn't go on to record more with him. But she had that kind of drifting sort of story. If you actually look at Nico's wider story, which is absolutely fascinating in itself and could easily be the subject of a whole other documentary, maybe it will be, she just kind of drifted through situations.
Yeah.
And this was one instance of it. But it's so great that she drifted through this particular one, I think.
Yeah, well, it's hard to think of Lou Reed singing Femme Fatale in the way that she sings it.
She built you up to just put you down. What a clown, 'cause everybody knows the thing she does to please. She's just a little tease. See the way she walks, hear the way she talks.
That's Femme Fatale, Nico singing from The Velvet Underground, and Nico and Paul McLoone is with us this evening talking about the new Todd Haynes documentary, The Velvet Underground. I suppose, Paul, it's a long documentary. It comes in at 2 hours, but there is a part, there kind of are two parts to the story in some ways after Cale, when the personnel changed.
Yes, pre and post John Cale, really, they become a different band. Still a great band, still for my money, the greatest of them all, but a different band. The departure of Cale, absolutely massive impact. More control goes to Reed. Cale is ousted by Reed I won't spoil it, but there's a bit of shenanigans whereby Cale suddenly finds himself no longer in the Velvet Underground. And Doug Yule, his replacement, is a great musician, like Cale, multi-instrumentalist. And in many ways, the band become, on the surface of things, perhaps a more conventional band.
Yeah.
But by this point, a tremendous live band. And there's a lot of live recordings. Most of the live recordings of the Velvets actually are from that second period with Doug Yule on bass and keyboards. And you can really get a sense of just what a tight and well-drilled band.
But we get a lot of archive material here from really important artists, including Bowie. Let's have a listen to what Bowie has to say. He's talking here about Lou Reed's lyrics.
Elements of what Lou was doing that were just unavoidably right. The nature of his lyric writing. Dylan had certainly brought a new kind of intelligence to pop songwriting, but then Lou had taken it to the avant-garde and had its roots in Baudelaire and Rimbaud. But at that time, it wasn't considered important.
And that's David Bowie in a clip there from The Velvet Underground, the new Todd Haynes documentary that Paul McLoone is speaking to us about this evening. We get a sense of Lou Reed's family in particular, and very clever use of the split screen where sometimes something's been said about Lou Reed and maybe drugs and his mental state, and you see his sister on the split screen and you know, oh, well, I'm interested to hear what she has to say about that. It's a cleverly crafted documentary in that respect.
It is. It's really, really well put together. And you can, I was kind of wondering when it was first mooted, and we've been waiting for this for a while. And I was kind of thinking, what's he going to do? Is he going to be all, you know, very, we all know Todd Haynes is a very, very clever guy, likes to do tons of research. He's a very crafty filmmaker. And I thought maybe it'll be a bit too crafty, you know, maybe he'll.
And was it?
It just works. He absolutely stays the right side of that line. And the way he deploys those multi-screen visuals is visually great, and also narratively it's kind of it layers it.
Will you hear what she has or he has to say about what you're watching on the other screen?
He's done a fantastic job, as I say, overcoming several pretty big hurdles.
We'll finish up with a little bit of Sweet Jane from Loaded, and this was after the Kale period. What does this track tell us about the Velvet Underground, Paul?
Well, it tells us that Lou Reed, above all else, was a tremendous rock songwriter.
Standing on the corner, suitcase in my hand, jacket's in his corset, Jane is in her vest, and me, I'm in a rock and roll band. Riding a Stutz Bearcat gym, you know, those were different times. All the poets, they studied rules of verse, and those ladies, they rolled their eyes.
Sweet Jane from the Velvet Underground album Loaded. And it was Paul McLoone who was speaking to us about the Velvet Underground documentary, the Todd Haynes documentary, which premieres on Apple TV Plus tomorrow evening, October 15th. Kit Downs is a BBC Jazz Award winner, Mercury Prize nominee and solo recording artist for the legendary ECM record label. His 2019 album, Dream Life of Debris, is inspired by the novel The Rings of Saturn by W.G. Sebald. And the music, if I can quote, explores the tangents and threads, subtleties and secrets of the wandering mind. Fans of jazz and experimentalism in sound can see Kit Downs on tour from next week as he brings his quartet on a short tour around the country. But right now he joins me on the line from Salzburg in Australia. In Austria, I beg your pardon. It hasn't moved just yet, has it,
Kit?
No, not quite. Listen, the music for the album The Rings of Saturn, Sebald, who the novel and the writer who inspired you here, just tell me how that made its way into the music that you were working on for that album in particular, Kit.
Sure. That book, for those that haven't read it, is a wonderful walking tour of Suffolk, which is, I'm from Norfolk, which is just the other side of the border, but there's pretty much the same kind of topography and the same kind of story. Suffolk is filled with old history and history that spreads out around all of the world, and Sebald explores it by doing this walking tour, and he visits different places and they bring up different tangents in his mind, some from very long ago, some from not from very long ago, from all over the world, from different, from like the dynasties in China to railways in America to recent political history in the UK. I mean, everything gets touched on, and the way that it's linked is through this kind of wandering mind that he has and the poetry that he has to kind of link those things together. I liked this as an analogy of how to bring tangential elements together. And the album itself features instruments that don't normally sit together. So things like the church organ, piano, electric guitar, cello, tenor saxophone, things that all have different connotations in terms of their aesthetics and their genres.
Yeah,
and I'm trying to find some kind of mutual common ground where they can meet felt like a fun challenge.
Yeah, particularly the saxophone and Tom. Challenger is Tom's name, isn't it? Your saxophone player, Tom Challenger.
It's not his nickname.
It is actually his name. It struck me that a bit like the Jan Garbarek idea of the saxophone in the church type of space. It really gives an expansive feel to this and a poetic feel to the kind of meditative feel to the piece that I'm going to listen to, Sculpture. How important was the church setting was very much involved in the genesis of this music, was it?
Yeah, and it's a big part of my history. I mean, I'm not religious and I don't go to church, but a lot of my musical experiences has been in churches. So I used to sing in a choir. I used to play a lot of organ in churches when I was younger. And there's something about the effect of that space on me, musically speaking, that is still very resonant in the stuff that I make today. So in that way, it's a callback to kind of my early experiences through music. But as you say, all of those instruments really have a wonderful effect in a big acoustic like that, like cello, saxophone, and electric guitar. I mean, electric guitar not played in maybe in the more conventional rock sense, but in a more sort of abstract. The guy's called Stian Vesterhus. He's from Norway, and he makes beautiful avant-garde kind of noise music, I guess you could call it. But the way that all those instruments can inhabit a big reverberant space was kind of a common theme anyway. So that's how, and the organ kind of wraps up all of their sound in its own enormous gargantuan sonic sphere anyway. So
let's have a listen to a little bit of I think it's quite early on the track listing on the album. This is a track called Sculpture. We'll only get a little section of it, but I want to give a sense of the sound that you're making. Just a little flavour there of Sculptor, it's the opening track, in fact, isn't it, on the album Dream Life of Debris. Mm-hmm. Kit Downs, jazz organ and pianist, speaking with me ahead of their Music Network tour in the next week or so here in Ireland. How do you get, is it difficult to recreate that kind of expansive sound that so beautifully is there on the record because of the church setting, I suppose? Is it difficult to recreate that in a live setting where essentially you're in concert halls or venues, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the nice thing about the organ is that it's always different and it's always in a different room. Like the instrument is designed to be, is literally designed its proportions to work acoustically in the church that it's put in. So part of the kind of mantra of being an organist is that you accept the limitations, but also the benefits of each individual instrument and room. And you carry that mindset forward as a group, even without the organ, even if you only have a piano, then you embrace whatever the realities of whatever situation you are, whether it's a dry small room that only fits 50 people or it's a big concert hall with an organ and a piano that fits 500 people. You find a way to manipulate the music, and hopefully the music is open-ended enough that it can withstand all of this kind of stretching and refining and moving around. And there's enough open improvisationary sections within all of the music that, And I have enough faith in the musicians as improvisers as well to find space in each different
piece.
Reiteration of it. You know?
Yeah, because on one occasion you'll be in St. Anne's Church in Dawson Street in Dublin. You'll have an organ there and the church setting. But also in the Triskell Christ Church in Cork, you'll have an organ in that setting as well. And I guess for an organist, you just have to take what's in front of you, because every organ will have its ups, beat and its positives and its advantages, but I'm sure they have their disadvantages too.
Absolutely, but as with people, like the vulnerabilities of certain instruments can be their most unique feature sometimes. And if you're open to experimenting with some of the sounds that they can make when they're not working fully, that can be very unique. And in fact, there's a track on the first record that I did for ECM, which is called Obsidian. There's a track called Rings of Saturn, which is obviously about the book itself. But that's all exploring one instrument that couldn't reach full pitch. Yeah. So the only thing it could do was these strange extended techniques in a way. It couldn't really play like a normal organ.
And hence the piece
fully
got,
properly. So.
Yeah, I suppose it's the Leonard Cohen thing, isn't it? It's the cracks that let the light in. lovely to have spoken with you this evening, Kit. That's Kit Downs, pianist and organist. He brings the music from his 2019 album Dream Life of Debris on tour around Ireland from next Tuesday, October the 19th. His quartet will be playing around the country until October the 26th. Donegal, Kildare, Dublin, Laois, Cork and Wicklow. Musicnetwork.ie will give you full details of venues, dates and times. That's our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Paddy Carney was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock.